Come back, my dears. I hope, however, that movement practice unfolded, that it was brought some sense of ease and nourishment and arrival to your psyche. That makes sense. All right. As I mentioned before, we'll just move into the sit. And before we do so, I want to invite each of us to allow our bodies to come into a posture that allows us to feel upright and alert. And for some of us, that might doesn't it's not posture dependent. It might be better for your body to lie down or to be standing, but it's sort of an inclining energetically to an alertness and to an availability to your own experience and to these teachings. So just noticing as you are taking your seat, if there are any micro or macro movements that might bring a little bit more ease, like a rounding up and back of the shoulders and opening up of the chest. As I mentioned before, kind of leaning back into the back body. On Zoom, sometimes we just lean in, but being able to inhabit our bodies fully. And it can be a helpful reminder to kind of lean back, even energetically, to include that part of our personal space. I often think of, little kids are told, like, stand in your hula hoop of energy, sort of the arms width out. And for us to kind of imagine just inhabiting our own space. And again, if it's helpful in these early moments as a form of anchoring, to think about the sit bones resting upon the cushion, the seat, the couch, the floor. The feet resting upon the earth. This is a way of reminding ourselves, oh yeah, we can rest here on this earth, hopefully in this sangha, ideally in this body. And for the anchor today, have us play in the realm of working with thoughts. So as we anchor ourselves in the body to invite in a sense of embodyingness. Often we'll sit with sort of my hands on the heart and belly. I'm just aware I'm doing that right now. This is a way of an invitation, again, arriving, remaining, resting. And from this place, just this great line from John Travis, calling it Spirit Rock, that we take our seats and to watch the theater of our mind. And as we sort of orient our awareness, our attention, and observe the thinking mind, which never ceases to amaze me that we can do this, observe our thinking. And I'm going to ask for a subtlety of our attention to rest on the energetics of the mind. As I mentioned before, some people share the feeling agitated. And again, it can be an agitation physically in the body, but the mind can also be agitated. The cadence, the flow, the pacing of the thoughts themselves. So, as alluring or as seductive as the content of the thoughts can be, ideally, kind of let that heart go and just use our attentional antennae, as it were, just to track what's the energetic quality of the thinking of these thoughts. Last week, we were looking more at patterns. Where does the mind roam when left on its own? And today, just looking at if it feels like it will be of benefit. What's the energetic quality? Is there a tightness, a speediness, an agitation, a slothfulness, a dullness, a fatigue? And again, it's a fairly precise or subtle invitation to pay attention to. And it may be more easeful just to kind of watch the patterning of the thoughts, noting the habitual patterns that come up, the things we, the repetitive thoughts. And then just seeing if we can drop down a little bit just to check in. Can I notice the energetic quality of the thoughts? Or even if the tone, if there's a harshness or a criticism or a sweetness, a kindness. So these are all just suggestions of ways to work with meditating on thoughts. Yeah. Different levels of awareness to the complexity of this thinking mind of ours. Please remember there's no such thing as a bad sit. We come, we take our seats, and we see how it is in this moment, in this body. And then there's another moment and another. And there's always the opportunity to begin again. Yeah. When we get caught or spun out or lost in thought, oh, right, come back in the body, noticing the thoughts, watching. With again, an invitation to have that gentle curiosity. Oh, in the mind, just now it's like this. Setting aside any judgments or needing it to be otherwise, or just sort of sitting with and noticing, ah, in this moment, the thinking mind is like this. There's a lot of energy. There's a lack of energy in the quality, the pacing, the tone of the thoughts. Again, please feel my gratitude that we get to all sit together and enjoy. I hope, however, the sit went. And sometimes the sits are just so unpleasant, right? Mine can be all over the place. And sort of that sense of being able to sit in that unpleasantness is so important and such a fabulous muscle to cultivate. So that sense of there's never a bad sit, sometimes they are unpleasant, but it's still okay. That's just where we are. Today we are still moving through my favorite book by Ajahn Sutito called Parmes, Crossing Life's Floods, and this progression through the perfections of the heart, and beginning with generosity, dana, and integrity, sila, renunciation, wisdom, and today the virya, often translated as energy, effort, determination, persistence. And this was partly in the instructions about what's the energy of the mind, because the invitation in working with this perfection of the heart, this heart quality, is really looking at where is our energy going? And in the rarefied capacity to just watch our thoughts, to be able to, if it worked, and it might not have, but to kind of know, like, oh, there's a lot of agitation here, or there's a real a slowness or a dullness of mind. So being able to even have the inquiry into, well, what is the energetic nature of the thoughts? Because it then translates when the mind is really busy, it impacts the nervous system, right? It's all of the piece. So sometimes it can be helpful just to notice, like, a lot of energy there. And then being able to think about how do we shift it, bring it down out of the mind into the body. So thank you for that link. And I feel like in the dominant culture, there's a way that we can be conditioned to sort of just move through on force of will. One of the great lines in his book, in Sutito's book, is he talks about there's sort of a misconception of this idea of not having enough energy. He's like, we all have enough energy. Like, what? But it's how we use it, how we allocate it, what expectations we have on ourselves. Because sometimes we might actually just be tired. And in a sort of wise response way, oh, rest, where we can. I feel like we're kind of inculcated to believe, well, if you're tired, you just keep going. You've got, when I was in law school a million years ago, it's in Portland. So it was sort of get to the gym at 5, drink a lot of coffee, be the first one to the library in the morning, be the last one in the library to leave. Lunch was basically Diet Coke and Snickers. It was not really sustainable, but it was that sort of sheer force of will to kind of grind through it. Yeah. And the ways that we can get caught in, that was one of my more extreme times, but the ways we can get caught in the sense of just push through. And not to say there aren't times where we have to, there are things that need our attention that we must do, but that we can have that definition of what we must do be broad. And there might be ways we can narrow it, because it comes at a cost of really paying attention to this phenomenal resource, which is our life's vitality. And we can squander it. And one way we can squander it is when the mind is kind of all over the place and sort of oozing out energy. It's not a skillful investment, right? So the sense that, oh, there's a limit, we all have this much energy. Some days we might have a lot, some days we might not, but how do we want to invest it? And bring the sense of intentionality and almost caution of, okay, how can I steward my energy in the way? And so when we're sick or we're just not feeling well, then the investment might be different. But to give ourselves permission to do so, it can go against a way of thinking of how we should be. So part of, I think, this invitation of working with virya as a heart quality. Yeah, and I think it's important to, there, virya can show up on various lists, and enlightenment or the mother list, which are escaping me at the time, at this moment. But to consider it as a heart quality, a perfection of the heart, is this wise investment in energy as an alignment with what we hold dear. What are our values? What are our ethical guidelines? What matters to us most? And if we can be clear as we sort of walk through the generosity, the examination of Sila, the integrity, again, ethics, morality, values, what's important to us from the consideration of the heart rather than the mind's idea of what we should be doing, and to keep coming back to, oh, these are heart practices. Because I'm a firm believer this, when we are more embodied in the heart and move from the energetics of the heart, we tend to be more congruent than when the mind or sheer force of will is at hand. Part of me, this is true. I had a really hard time in law school. I was not at my happiest. And it was part, I was really outside of what was true in my heart. And there was a lot of just sort of grit and determination that, like, oh, I'm going to get through this, which had its own satisfaction, of course. But that way we can catch ourselves of, like, I got to get through it. Again, sometimes it's absolutely necessary. And sometimes, like, what am I doing? Am I actually going to live from this place? Which is not to say we don't strive, that we don't have intentions and desires and achievements along the path, but we are emboldened by the energies of the heart towards wholesome qualities. He, in the book, he talks about applied energy, how we apply this resource that resists the push of psychological habit, the sankharas, and the habits that can build into these habits, which is why, if we were here last week, kind of looking at what's the patterning, what are the habits of the mind, and it can be so helpful to look at that, because what the mind considers so inclines the mind. With our thoughts, we create the world. So it's a really great place to start. And when we start to examine our utilization of this resource of our own energy, it's interesting. He speaks about programs. Mental programs like perfectionism or dependence, codependence on others, obsessive self-criticism or addictions, and that these mental programs cripple our actions and well-being and use up our resources. Yeah. So I'm very skilled at worrying. I can, my mind can easily go there. It can, it's companion of planning. I'm a very good planner, but part of that is driven from being a very good worrier and being able to kind of, hey, what am I doing? Is this really helping me? And those questions that certainly come in this chapter that I talk about quite frequently of, is what I'm thinking or what I'm doing, how I'm behaving, leading me towards ease, or is it stressing me out? So when I'm kind of caught in a worry vortex, not so good. Does not help me. Okay, so then can I change directions? But that can be, would be considered kind of a program of the mind, a habit. Another phrasing might be sort of the default neural network. That doesn't really serve us. It's just habituated from when we were young and devising strategies to survive. And through this awareness practice, particularly when we work with a thinking mind, it's like, do I want to be thinking this? And or Byron Katie's beautiful questions, which I think are born out of teachings of the Dalai Lama, is what I'm thinking true? Is it really true? How do I know it's true? And what if it wasn't? And I love that their fourth question, because it's like, oh, what if the story I tell about myself or about someone else wasn't true? Even in the moment, that kind of, oh, there can be a liberatory quality of energy of, oh, this energy that has is connected to that story I tell about myself or another could be liberated and used elsewhere. He writes, the program of habit is like a virus. It infiltrates our immune system by posing as a real and necessary aspect of our identity. We defend them. He uses an example of like a workaholic. I'd be like, well, I have to do this. This is what's necessary. And that question of, is it? Is it really? The programs offer an identity through a set of habits that kick in by default. And so that's sort of nature of a default neural network. So when a wave of loneliness or passion hits awareness, it doesn't face risk and discomfort of challenging the self-view. But awareness can jump on board and get in line with that habit. And we move into sort of distraction, denial, and blame. And when this program continues to kind of well up and take over, it floods the attention and our intentions to follow the push of the flood. So we just get carried away. Yeah. So this way of being able again to slow down enough, like, oh, there's that thought pattern, this story I have about myself or about another, a concretization around a belief, a rigidity that comes in. And again, this a marvelous and awe-inspiring capacity we have to be able to watch our thoughts. And I constantly am awed by this, I think in part because I had such an unpleasant succession of mind states in my youth and through my 20s. So this ability to be like, oh, my thoughts aren't true necessarily. And that flex in freedom and then choice. Oh, I could change this thought channel over here. I could bring in loving kindness. I could bring in thoughts of equanimity and joy as a comparative or a replacement thought pattern. So he writes, energy is needed to resist that pull, that flood, and the energy is needed to direct the attention elsewhere. If we don't have access to our life's vitality or our energy, it's really hard to actually put into action. This thought pattern is really hard and unpleasant. I'm going to change the channels because that shift, that inclining somewhere else requires energy. And sometimes when the thought patterns or the programs, as he calls them, are pretty set, that neural network is really well paved, it's hard to get out. Like we get down that rabbit hole and it's like, I'm in the rabbit hole. And it can take a lot of energy to kind of jumpstart ourselves out. So this is why he kind of points to watch where you're investing your energy. Energy is about sustaining a wise effort. The chief function of this energy is to keep awareness awake at places where we drift into the automatic, right? Where the habits of the mind take over and all of a sudden we're lost spinning around something because we've lost our energetic connection to the awareness of what am I actually thinking? I would love this line. The mind's natural inclination is to orbit and check out what's happening in its external and internal domain. Right? That's the mind's just like looking outside. Is there a problem? Is there something I need to be aware of? Internally, is there a problem that I might have created that I should be aware of and pay attention to? So the attention gets caught up by attraction, aversion, or confusion, and those forces of attraction, aversion, or confusion capture the energy and overwhelm the mind. And I'm guessing many of us know that sense of when the mind is overwhelmed, it's like, it'd get a headache, or we just get so upset. And with the mind, and sort of the emotions float in, again, the mental processes or these programs kick in, and we're sort of really, we can be kind of helpless or just sort of at the whim of these mind patterns that aren't serving us. Yeah. So one of the best ways to use our energy is to apply this investigation, that the energy of investigation, what's going on, using our energy to inquire into ourselves again with investigation and perseverance, in order that we can understand, oh, this is where the mind's going. Is this useful or is this not? He writes, how can we can use energy to help free the mind from stress and suffering. How amazing is that? May it be so, right? To really be able to have that muscle and confidence that with the skillful application of our energy, we can lead the mind out of stress and suffering. And he points to the steps of doing this, a wise restraint. Again, the sense of if I'm worrying about something, wait, this is going to give me a headache. Can I change the channel and think about something else or substitute thoughts again, like with loving kindness phrases? Or other mechanisms, but even this note, like, oh, my thinking this thought is really agitating me. Just calling it out is super helpful and it interrupts that pattern or that program. And the second way of working or flexing this muscle to move the mind more into freedom is this inquiry and insight. Oh, this is what this mind of mine is doing. He speaks also about the essential, what would be the word? The necessity of boundaries, right? The boundaries around, okay, I'm not going to think about this, which is somewhat easier said than done. But I've shared this before and other times I've spoken about energy, but I find it so useful. that when he talks about boundaries, it's not so much, oh, this person drains my energy, so I set a boundary between me and someone else. It's much more setting a boundary around what's supportive and what is not, a no boundary and a yes boundary. So that when looking at, again, where's our energy going? Is this valuable? Is this onward leading? Is this leading me to ease? Is it spin, or do I spin? Am I just getting stressed out? Is it harming myself or another? So sort of saying yes, being able again to sit in that observational place to say yes or no. Being able to understand what causes unmindful states to grow and what causes skillful states to grow. So again, this importance of inquiry of what's actually happening and slowing down enough to watch the pattern of the minds, which requires enough energy and attention to notice, oh, this is what's going on. I'm going to get back to the boundaries in a second, but the energy has four, classically, the teachings are fourfold applications. Again, that sense of putting aside that which is unhelpful, guarding against, so the unskillful applications of the mind or those programs don't run as frequently, or they can slow them down a little bit. Establishing in ourselves, like, oh, this is what's onward leading. This is where there's can be some ease. And then supporting and encouraging those skillful influences. And again, it's bringing in discernment, it's bringing in wisdom, it's bringing in that kind of wider lens of, oh, this is what's going on. As opposed to when we're caught in the patterning of mind where we're just sort of off to the races with wherever the mind wants to go, it's often not good, right? Wisdom is an asset for healing and applying energy that helps you know where the mind gets caught or spins out. The yes boundary is determining what you want to apply your energy to. And I love this line. We become intimate with the aspirations of our heart. And being able to drop into, or even identify, or reflect upon, or inquire into the aspirations of the heart. Because that's as these perfections of the heart, the teachings of these paramis are suggesting, oh, you can rest here. This is reliable. This is trustworthy. This is a place to rest. This is a refuge. And the first step of cultivating this refuge is faith. Pali word is sadha. My favorite translation of sadha, sort of what do we rest the heart upon? He writes, faith is the intuitive sense that there is meaning in life, that there are aims and energies that are worth more than just getting by. And this, I think, the life-giving affirmation that there is meaning and purpose and beauty, right? That's sort of its own cyclical support when we can connect into that energy. And part of that is fed by a reliance upon our faith and confidence. And like another question in is sort of where does our value of vitality come from? What keeps us alive? And faith is brought forth as a willingness, an aspiration, the healthy willingness to do, which is classically done as beautiful in the beginning. So it's sort of aligning ourselves, our aspiration, our intentionality and intentions to be lean, engage with the wholesome, engage what is not causing stress or harm. So beautiful in the beginning. As we bring more investigative energies into an inquiry, sort of healthy doubt, like, is this working? Is this actually changing? Does this fit at all? Is there a resonance with this teaching? So that inquiry is beautiful in the middle. Yeah, as we deepen our faith. And then beautiful in the end is this being able to abide in trust of, oh yeah, these heart qualities, my investment of energy into my heart is sustainable, it's true, it's coherent, and life affirming. The quote that many of you know from Thomas Merton, the rush, and this is a while ago, I think he wrote it in the 50s. 60s. The rush and pressure of modern life are a form, perhaps the most common form, of innate violence. To allow ourselves to be carried away by a multitude of conflicting concerns, to surrender to too many demands, to commit oneself to too many projects, To want to help everyone and everything is to succumb to violence. More than that is cooperation in violence. The frenzy is cooperation in violence. The frenzy of activists neutralizes his work for peace. It destroys his inner capacity for peace. It destroys the fruitfulness of his own work because it kills the root of inner wisdom, which makes life fruitful. And we can hold activists in any which way that we want, but that way of the it's almost like the greed mind can come in of saying yes, saying yes, saying yes, I'll do more, I'll do more, I'll do more. But being able to really see it through this lens of that we're actually causing harm to ourselves, there's a violence in violating our own boundaries. Like, I can't do that. It is not, it's not to my benefit nor to the benefit of others if I'm stretched too thin or I'm have no resource or nurturance left. And how to be able to shift out of an expectation culturally that we just do and do and do, and the busier we are, the better. And it's not sustainable. And it's not necessarily heart-driven. And how do we stay connected again to the aspirational qualities of the heart? From the book, in we can see that there is energy associated with establishing, with doing, with being. So we establish ourselves in the practice. We establish ourselves in being able to watch the mind. We establish ourselves in the commitment to inquire and really be curious about the patterning of the mind, those programs, that's what serve and that's which don't. The energy leads towards attachment to a self-image and burden that image represents. However, we can arouse and nurture a different energy, one that is associated with being beyond any image, beyond any sense of self-concept, beyond this image of these programs that run or that sort of default neural network. If we open up into the silence of mind, where we are not monks or nuns, men or women, then there is a beautiful, stable energy that supports letting go of burdens. This is why energy is one of the primary factors of awakening. Because through the cultivation of energy and the moving through the processes of inquiry, we can get to a place of, oh, I can just rest here. I can rest in this awareness. From David White, what to remember upon waking, that we think about how do we greet each day in terms of where am I going to invest my energy? And I think it's a worthy endeavor to consider. Not just in the morning, but sort of through the day. How am I investing my energy? He writes, in the first hardly noticed moment in which you wake, coming back to this life from the other, more secret, movable, and frighteningly honest world where everything began, there is a small opening into the new day that closes the moment you begin your plans. What you can plan is too small for you to live. What you can live wholeheartedly will make plans enough for the vitality hidden in your sleep. To become human is to become visible while carrying what is hidden as a gift to others. To remember the other world and this world is to live your life, is to live in your true inheritance. You are not a troubled guest upon this earth. You are not an accident amidst other accidents. You are invited from another and greater night than the one from which you have just emerged. Now, looking through the slanted light of the morning window towards the mountain presence of everything that can be, what urgency calls you to your one love? What shape waits in the seed of you to grow and spread its branches against a future sky? Is it waiting in the fertile sea, in the trees beyond the house, in the life you can imagine for yourself, in the open and lovely white page on the writing desk? So this pause, this connection, and of being able to inquire what calls to you and your one true love, what shape waits in the seed of you to grow and spread. I'll read one more poem and then we'll do an exercise. Got a little carried away today. From Rumi, that lives in us. If you put your hands on this oar with me, they will never harm another. And they will come to find they hold everything you want. If you put your hands on this oar with me, they will no longer lift anything to your mouth that might wound your precious, precious land, that sacred earth that is your body. If you put your soul against this war with me, the power that made the universe will enter your sinew from a source not outside your limbs, but from a holy realm that lives in us. Exuberant is existence, time a husk. When the moment cracks open, ecstasy leaps out and devours space. Love goes mad with blessings. Like my words give, why lay yourself on the torturer's rack of past and present? The mind that tries to shape tomorrow beyond its capacities will find no rest. Be kind to yourself, dear, to our innocent follies. Forget any sounds or touch you knew that did not help you dance. You will come to see that all evolves us. If you put your heart against the earth with me in serving every creature, our beloved will enter you from our sacred realm, and we will be so happy. So I'm going to ask you to close your eyes and just take a moment to kind of come back into yourself. With a lot of words, feel yourself sitting on the chair or the couch. Invite each of us perhaps back into the moment when we awoke this morning, or imagining waking up tomorrow morning and allowing yourself to linger in this question of living wholeheartedly in this moment. What calls to you? What do you love? Where do you feel most alive? With whom do you feel most alive? In what setting do you feel most alive? What do you love? In this line of questions, just notice what emerges without saying yes or no to anything, but to kind of see what does come. Where do I feel most alive? With whom do I feel most alive? When in my life have I felt most alive? What do I love? What matters? And allowing yourself to drop into that imagined or felt sense of vitality. A vitality connected to the intimate aspirations of the heart's movement, the heart's sure desire, the heart's sure release. That this is a trustworthy life force. And when we invest our energies here along this pathway, there is a congruence, there is an honesty. How does it feel, again, if we imagine into it or can remember back into a time where we felt connected to this vitality? What do you notice in the body? Imagining, as Rumi invites us, to put our hands on this ore of vitality, this connection to the heart's energy, to trust. To have faith and confidence in this perfection of the heart that can invest our life's energies into the aspirations of the heart to follow that which we love, that which gives us meaning. Might we live if this were the anchor of our life, that we could tap into this vitality, to switch the metaphor a little, this known, reliable vitality born out of the heart's wisdom and aspiration and light. How is it to give yourself permission to take refuge here? And what it might your life be like living from this place, emboldened by the energy and vitality of the heart's wisdom?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.